WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The first thing that attracted me to Jane Shore's poems was the title of her book, Music Minus One. It's named after those recordings musicians can practice with, records with arrangements that leave a space for your instrument. Turns out the title poem is about her father, who gave up his career performing with big bands to help raise the family. The intriguing title led me to lots of poems I enjoyed. Music Minus One has just come out in paperback. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Jane Shore recorded last spring. The poems in the book are very autobiographical, about growing up in a Jewish family in the 50s and 60s. She lived upstairs from her parents' dress shop in New Jersey. With subjects like vacationing in the Catskills, shopping for bargain underwear in the 5 and 10, shaving your legs, and playing dead, these poems are about the details that form you. The book was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award. Jane Shore teaches creative writing at George Washington University and lives in Washington, D.C. and Vermont. I spoke with her last spring and asked her to read an excerpt of her poem, Heatwave, Cold War.
I wheeled my baby sister to the park. The baseball diamond deserted, a dusty, wavering mirage. It was hot, so hot the Chamber of Commerce canceled the annual chicken barbecue, the coals already burning under the empty grills. My father closed up early. We lounged around all afternoon in our apartment over the store. My mother wore her sheerest bra and panties. My father stripped to his boxer shorts. He sat at the kitchen table in the path of the fan, like a game of solitaire, the ticket stubs, the week's receipts before him. I was cutting out a family of paper dolls, wool winter coats and hats, the daughter's organdy party dress. My elbow stuck to the vinyl tablecloth, my thighs to the vinyl cushions. I was wearing the thick cotton underpants I'd worn throughout my childhood, my chest bare in front of my father for the very last time. The Cold War was on TV. My scissors cut along the shoulders, hips, the perfect neutral bodies. The father didn't have my father's bald spot, nor the mother, my mother's belly. Their modest children, a girl and a boy, had underwear painted onto their skin. I cut out their split-level house in the country, their collie, their crew-cut lawn. I cut out their flagstone patio, shady backyard. The kit even had a fallout shelter with walls of painted shelves filled with canned goods and bottled water. Too hot to talk, too hot to eat, we lowered the blinds and sat in the dark all day and evening. Turning on lamps only made more heat. We camped out on the living room sofa, Ozzie and Harriet, canned laughter, the news. The station signed off. Jets flew in formation to the strains of the national anthem. When the peacock's tail feathers fanned out, an array of grays, my father flicked the dial. We watched a white dot fade and shrink to nothing in the center of the blackened screen. Finally, we all tried to sleep. My mother lay down in the twin bed across from mine, on top of her separate sheet, dabbing her forehead with a cold washcloth. During the night, the fever broke. Only juice for breakfast. At 10 a.m., in shorts and a halter, I went downstairs with my father. He unlocked the store, 30 seconds to turn off the alarm. Inside smelled stuffy like a closet. He got the big ceiling fan going. Cooling air rustled through the dress racks. I had left my mother working at the kitchen table, pasting up the ad for Sunday's paper, snipping and gluing the cutout models on the page under Corduroy Village Summer Sale, 20% off. While my father dusted the counter, I modeled jewelry for no one. The first customer walked in about 11. Formal to the end, under his suit jacket, my father wore a short-sleeved shirt and kept his tie tied until closing.
Jane Shore, I think one of the things that I like so much about your poems is your sense of detail and the triggers that some of those details set off in me. I think some of your poems just set off these like sense memory reactions. And I'm wondering if you always gravitated toward the details of your memories and of day-to-day life.
When I was growing up, one of the things I loved to do was paint. I was very interested in the visual world, painting, and because my parents had a store and because there were clothes in the store, women's clothes, I was always very interested in the specific details of what I saw before me. But I think I always went for the visual rather than the oral. I always felt that I loved seeing things. I love seeing the things around me, and I love seeing stuff in the world, the things of the world, just walking around and looking around.
Let me read a couple of lines that are again, kind of the details of life that, for me, evoke real sense memories. I snapped my rubber bathing cap under my chin, tucking in my ponytail, an inch down the ladder into the pool, aquamarine as the birthstone ring I'd left in our hotel room for safekeeping. I remember the bathing cap. I had the ponytail. I sometimes got into pools in the summer. I remember when every girl I knew had a birthstone ring, the amethyst or the turquoise, whatever the other stones were. I guess these were the details of life. I always figured one had to leave to become a poet. You had to kind of give up this boring world of the rubber bathing cap and find a much more interesting world to write about if you were going to write poetry.
Yes, that's what my teachers told me that. They said that poems had to be about life, death, love, beauty, and nature. And that's what poems were about. And it struck me that in my life, filled with bathing caps and bras and...
right, which you also write about.
that it was certainly far from beauty and certainly not about life and death at all. So, but the older I get, I find the more I return to those things of, those specific things of childhood, those specific objects, which I just can't let them go. It's like going into an antique store and something calls you to
them. Yes, exactly. That's funny because I think you just described exactly the feeling I have from some of your poems. Did you ever try to write poems with more exalted subject matter?
Well, I hope that even though the poems, you mean sitting down to be profound.
Exactly. Like yes. Reaching for those big subjects, the life, the death. I mean, your poems are about life and death, but actually literally writing about them in a more literal way.
When I was 14 and 15, I wrote a lot of poems about life. And I wrote poems about the womb of oblivion. That was my big line. Or the kaleidoscope of life. And it turns out that that's what my students write about, too, mm-hmm. although they're not 14 and 15. They're a little bit older than that. But I think that's where everybody starts. And I actually think I set out to write poems that I felt were about profound subjects so I could baffle my parents so that they wouldn't understand what it was I was writing about. And I think I'm not that kind of poet. I really feel I don't get the kind of pleasure. I don't know. I think when I was starting to write and as I began writing more, I guess I didn't feel like I had any really big ideas. And that if you were going to write about the smaller things or the things that appeared to be uninteresting, except to yourself, that if the poem was really going to work the way it should work, it would somehow touch on the larger things. But if I sit down and say, now I'm going to write a poem about life, I just can't do it. But if I say, now I'm going to write a poem about a Mahjong bracelet I have or a Mahjong set I have, very quickly I can find, once I start exploring what that object is or that game is, I can start finding deeper things, although I don't consciously know it when I sit down to write it.
My guest is Jane Shore, and her latest book of poems is called Music Minus One. There's another poem I'd like you to read from the book, and it's the poem called Workout. Before you read it, would you tell us what inspired the poem?
I have a sister who's 8 years younger than I am, and she had to really follow in my footsteps in a lot of ways. And it's about, I guess it's my sibling rivalry poem. It's about growing older and feeling that who has the advantage, perhaps, feeling the kind of burden of being the older sister. Also, I know there's a burden of being a younger sister. And also, everyone says that the older sister is the one who's the nice, well-behaved girl, and the younger sister is the one who's the rebel. And so I guess both sisters have their burdens to carry. But my sister is a folk singer also, and she sings country and western and folk. And I think she inherited the musical talent in my family. And this is a poem about that, about feeling that one passes through stages of life. It's about rivalry. It's about wanting to not have a sister, I think, at times. Although now I'm very happy I have a sister. Workout. My sister is doing her exercises, working out in my husband's study. The rowing machine sighs deeply with every stroke. It's heavy breathing, like a couple making love. She's visiting from Iowa, where the cold weather is much worse. When she was 10, I'd hear her strumming her guitar through the bedroom wall. She'd borrow my albums, my Joan Baez, my Dylan, and sing along, shutting me out, drawing me in, imitating my hair, my clothes, my generation. I used to feel sorry for her, for being 8 years younger. She opens the door a crack and surfaces in earphones and wearing pink bikini panties and a lover's torn t-shirt. Strapped to her hands are the weights that weighed her suitcase down. Her thighs are tight, her triceps shine, her body is her trophy. The night she arrived, we sprawled across my bed, her cosmetic bag spilled open, and she shadowed my eyelids violet, demonstrating the latest tricks, the way I used to make her up on those nights she watched me dress for dates, watched me slip into my miniskirt, my sandals, my love beads. Now she's no longer in love with me and eyes me pityingly, triumphant, her expression the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. She's got to keep in shape. She's a performer. It's her business to look beautiful every night. Sometimes, when she begins to sing, men in the audience fall in love. She's warming up in the shower. The tile walls amplify her voice, safe for once under temperate rain. Like a dress handed down from sister to sister, in time, one body will inherit what the other has outgrown.
Has your sister read the poem?
Yes. In fact, she said, when she read it, she said, well, it's the one poem that you wrote about me, and I don't love it, but, you know, it's the way you really felt. Yes, it is. It is. I know that I read it. I realize, well, I guess I knew it when I was writing it, too. I'm 8 years older. I'm a lot of pounds heavier. It's about rivalry.
There's the line in the poem when you say that your sister's expression was the same as mine when I watched my mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror. What did you think about when you watched your mother examine her face in the magnifying mirror?
You don't want to think that you're actually going to be like that once yourself. And in fact, I'm working on a poem right now in which I've inherited my mother's magnifying mirror. And I don't like what I see. I mean, what I see is my mother's face. You look at yourself getting older, and you think when you're a younger person, that'll never happen to me. And when I'm that age, I'm going to be really beautiful because I'm really going to take care of myself.
No, when I'm that age, I'm going to be really young.
That's right. I'm still going to look just the way I look when I'm 20. But in fact, it's absolutely true that you look at yourself and it magnifies who you are. It magnifies your faults and maybe your good things, too. But unfortunately, I look just like my mother now. And my sister knows that. So
she scores a point for that?
Well, you know, I realized also, I mean, at the end of the poem, it's a kind of curse. You know, one day you're going to get what I don't, you know, what I have now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a kind of curse. I guess that was my last, I had to get one last lick in. My sister was not thrilled with this poem.
My guest is poet Jane Shore. Her book is called Music Minus One. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with poet Jane Shore.
The title poem from your book, Music Minus One, is about your father.
Yes.
Who used to play with big bands, I guess, in the 30s and 40s, played with Clyde McCoy. Did Clyde McCoy have the recording of Sugar Blues?
Yes, and this is an amazing thing that just happened. I was in San Francisco last week, and I was in a bookstore. And I was leaving the bookstore, and on the way out, I walked by the music aisle. And a title caught my eye, and it was the big band's almanac. And I thought, well, hey, let me just take a look at this and see what's in there. So I looked up M, and I looked up Clyde McCoy. And there, the picture of Clyde McCoy's band was a picture of my father, taken in 1936, I think, when he must have been 21 years old. And there he is playing. And I almost died. It's the first time that my inside, what I felt was my personal inside history, suddenly was, there I was in the bookstore, and there was a picture of my father.
Now, your father had to give up music, I guess, to be home with the family, maybe, or?
Well, it was after, he had played before the war, then he had gone, he'd been a Marine in the war, and he'd play, I guess he'd led the Marine band. He played in the South Pacific. And when he came home, it was another world. He married my mother, and I was born a year later. And I think he felt that music was no life for, if you wanted to be a family man, you couldn't stay out all night playing music. You couldn't lead your wild, crazy life that you'd lived before. And he right away went to work in a music repair shop on the Lower East Side. He did that for a year or two. And then I think he was just really looking around to see what he could do. And my mother had been a saleswoman, I think at Bamberger's or Stern's in Newark, selling cosmetics. And they decided to go into business. And in the beginning, he was just going to help her. And then as the years progressed, he got more and more involved in the business.
I'm wondering if when you started writing, you thought, well, I'm going to stick with it. My father had to give up playing professionally and ended up owning a store, but I'm going to stick with this writing thing.
I think that was the center of what I always felt the sadness that my father had. And even though I would say, Dad, you know, wouldn't you rather be playing now? Wouldn't you rather be in the band? Wouldn't you rather be on television with all your buddies that you see on Johnny Carson? And he'd say, no, I'm quite content. I can listen to my music. And because he had a tremendous collection of records. He'd listen to the radio day and night. But I never really believed him. Never. I thought, well, why would you want to give up that glamorous life for this? But in fact, I think that you're right. I think that if you have a commitment to something that you really, really love, and if it's possible to do it, and I think you make it possible to do, then you should do it. And with my father, I think there were circumstances. He was born, it was the Depression. People had a different mentality. They gave up a lot of things that I think I certainly nowadays probably would not give up.
I have one more question for you. You said before that you respond really well to encouragement. As a teacher, how do you handle encouragement and criticism?
I immediately, because I had wonderful teachers in college and graduate school, I think that a person does not do well when they're yelled at or when they're made fools of. I feel that if you write a poem and there's one terrific line in it or one image in it, you should know that you did that. And I believe that poetry and all art grows through nurture. And I try to treat my students the same way that my teachers treated me, which was really encouraging, really. But when you do something that's not so good, when you write a cliche, you have to be told also so that you won't keep making the same mistake. And also with my students, everybody has a very unique life. Each person has a unique life, and only they know what they can write about. And that's the thing I try to get to them. I think if you try to write about everything that you see around you that's not you, you won't get art, you won't get a good poem. But the more particular you get, the more specific you get in your life and in your art, I think that's when the really good work happens.
Well, Jane Shore, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Jane Shore's book, Music Minus One, has just been published in paperback by Picador. She teaches creative writing at George Washington University. Well, this is Sugar Blues, played by Clyde McCoy and his orchestra, the band her father played with. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.